It may have been odd to anyone visiting the palliative care unit to hear laughter bursting out of one particular room time and again, but my family has always enjoyed good-natured joking and teasing. For about a week, everyone was home, a relatively rare experience for us, and we spent most of that time in the hospital. While Dad held his place amongst us, we told funny stories about him, like the time he went to hang up his jacket at the top of the basement stairs. A moment later, we heard a metallic glissando, the inimitable sound of an avalanche of coat hangers falling down the stairs. And then a shout, "I hate coat hangers!" which became a phrase we teased him with for many years after. Or the time we were on vacation in Nova Scotia, when Dad was under the hood of our overheated car by the side of a road. Though we were visible for a mile in either direction, a car whizzed by way too fast and close, its horn honking only when it was practically upon us. My mom was so mad, she blasted the horn right back at him. We didn't have to see Dad jump to know that that was a big mistake. And his profanity-free rage was much funnier than if he'd sworn like a sailor. "You dullard!" That was a new word for us boys. Now, I'm making it sound as though my father was angry all the time, but in fact, that's the funny part of it. He was very patient and soft-spoken and calm, and so it made it all the more funnier. All the more funny, excuse me, when he lost it like that. But to get back to the time I'm talking about, there we were all on summer vacation after all those years, but this time spent in our hometown hospital, telling these stories again, laughing, adding our two bits, and then all going quiet for a while, retreating into private thought. Dad lay there, saying nothing. He was in a coma during the last few days of his battle with cancer. Yes, it must have sounded odd to people visiting other patients, but my family and our closest friends were living one of our most precious, memorable, and bonding events, laughing and laughing. And grieving. You may well have memories of such a time, your own proof of why the words bitter and sweet go so well together. When I was first seeing a spiritual director, I talked about this. I'd always expected that the capacity for happiness would grow as spirituality matures and we become more accepting of life. Instead, I was discovering that as spiritual growth continues, ambivalent feelings become more frequent. Neither pure happiness nor pure sadness could last for long anymore. Increasingly, they shared room in the heart. Upon hearing this, my director went over to his bulletin board and took down this handmade greeting card. Just a few days ago, I finally remembered where I had squirreled it away, and so I brought it today. Years before that day, my director had received it from one of his parishioners who had sent it to him after she'd given birth on the same day that her mother had died. Someday I'll give it to another person who needs it. At that time, I recognized the words on the card as a poem of William Blake's. But only later did I realize that these are the lyrics for hymn number 17 in our hymn book. And it goes, "Joy and woe are woven fine, a clothing for the soul divine, under every grief and pain. pine runs a joy with silk and twine. It is right, it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe, and when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. Now, when I first came across those words as a freshman in English at the age of 17, I didn't understand what they meant at all. But now I understand. Blake addresses a core, continuing spiritual struggle. How to accept and value both joy and woe. Pondering this problem, I looked up joy in the Encyclopedia of Religion. It isn't there. Now, what possible good is religion if you can't find joy in its encyclopedia? But then, woe isn't there either. So religion seemed to be telling me that I had to figure this out for myself. In our younger years, most people experience joy as excitement and elation, in other words, a kind of high, like surfing on the coast of a 10-foot wave. This kind of exciting joy can become an end in itself. We can pursue it like a country dog chasing every passing car. Maybe this time I'll actually catch it and grab it. We continue to hope that our own story will end in happily ever after. There's a fantasy novel, in fact, called Nobody's Son, in which the story begins at the happily ever after moment, and then goes on to talk about the nitty-gritty that comes after that. And after we live through some of that nitty-gritty, we give up on elation. It passes so quickly. But then joy can grow deep and expansive rather than high, as though it's been enriched by the experience of trouble and difficulty. Joy isn't carefree, innocent happiness, blissful though that may be. It's the appreciation of how blessed we are with good things when there is so much in life that hurts. It's the hearty welcoming of moments of happiness, which no matter how frequently they come, are always too rare. But before we can achieve that kind of woe, we have to figure out how to endure all those things that hurt so much. Feelings of loss, rejection, failure, betrayal. The lucky amongst us receive a balanced measure of positive and negative experiences and find a smoother, though no less valuable, path towards wisdom. Some of us who appear to be the most fortunate, those to whom nothing bad ever seems to happen, are too often, I fear, unprepared for that first inevitable big bump in the road, the first stop sign, the first casualty. If you happen to feel you're one of these people, you can ready yourself by sticking with those around you who aren't so fortunate. You can become an adept companion for those who are suffering. You can learn to become someone who is seen as a true friend through thick and thin, not one who runs away from uncomfortable situations. You can be one of those who does some of the dirty work in the world. There are, of course, those of us who seem cursed with troubles, problems pile upon difficulties complicated by disasters. Nothing like the right answer for us appears in any self-help book or on any Oprah show. When we have this kind of life, we might find meaning in a text like the book of Job, from the Hebrew Bible. Even the non-believer can read it as a mythical, eternal tale about facing personal disaster with fortitude. Now I'll come back to Job shortly, but first there are a couple of points that I must make. I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that woe is good for anyone, or that it is ever to be endured for the sake of some future reward, when it should be stopped or prevented. Abuse and suffering are not spiritual experiences. We also must never tell someone else that her suffering has meaning, or is part of a plan, or will serve any purpose. To do that is arrogant, as though we presume to know anything about what meaning someone else will find in her life. If we are asked, we can offer what meaning we have found. But at first, the person's experience needs only to be held and accepted. Our Unitarian Universalist principles urge us to prevent or reduce unnecessary pain whenever we can. But often, that is simply by sitting with somebody through his agony. As the slogan from Al-Anon goes, don't just do something, stand there. Rather, what I am saying is that woe is inescapable, and it changes us. There's a risk that the change will be for the worse, leading to despair, cynicism, or depression. It's always tempting to surrender in the negative sense, to give up trying, to let our hearts collapse into apathy or lethargy. I think one of the temptations that life dangles before us is exactly this, to let everything go and settle for what little we have as we wait for it all to be over with. But this is choosing to be numb. It's spiritual death, and it denies all that life in the universe stands for. We must ever and again turn away from this temptation to waste life. An alternative is that by letting woe disrupt our routine living, we can let ourselves be forced to dust off our beliefs and theories and put them into action in reality. We can put our principles where our mouths are and let ourselves be shaken to the core so new blood can flow into our spiritual and ethical guts. What this can do for us is suggested by theologian Richard Rohr in his book, Job and the Mystery of Suffering. Rohr says that it is only through woe that we experience authentic joy. If we try to deny or escape our pain, all we can feel is superficial happiness. Woe transforms us into beings who can feel deep and expansive joy because we have felt its opposite. In this sense, joy is pleasure that is steeped in gratitude and measured by perspective. It is all the more sweet because its limitations are well known. Part of the meaning of suffering can be that it opens the possibility of genuine joy. Rohr also says that to enter more deeply into this mystery of life, we have to allow ourselves to feel, not just to know, to feel what it means to be empty, abandoned, uncared for, an entire life's stance, a standing under, so that we can understand. What he means is that seeing life from underneath, weighed by burdens, lets us know what existence is really like, and we can feel a greater connection, an empathy, an interdependence with all fellow beings. Our feelings of loss, rejection, failure, and betrayal can lead us toward a deeper life. Rohr calls this process conversion. When it happened to me, I called it being born again, and there wasn't a trace of Christianity in it. I feel born again. We don't have to let other people own words that can have a different meaning for us. If you prefer, you might want to think of it as spiritual evolution or transformation. But whatever we call it, woe can renovate the heart. I frequently find in the arts plans and tools that help with this renovation. One example was the poem I read this morning. Not so much because Melvin the collie is so gloriously happy to accept whatever little things life gives him on any particular day. Rather, it's the narrator's witnessing of the possibility of joy surrounded by muck that touches me. The narrator can barely tolerate being shown how little it could take to find joy in bleak. Also, the film City of Angels with Nicolas Cage and Meg Ryan is an example. If you don't know it, in it, beings of light live invisibly side by side humans. They see our struggles and agonies dispassionately, helping us by giving us a moment of insight, but they themselves do not feel anything except perhaps a distant compassion. Every morning, the angels gather to watch the sunrise over the beach to the accompaniment of celestial music. One of them, Seth, falls in love with a woman, a human woman, Maggie, making him yearn to feel physical sensation and human emotion. He lets himself fall to earth to be with her. And after only one night together, she suffers an accident. As she's dying, she feels sorry that she has encouraged Seth to become human. But he tells her that it was worth it to lose his angelic powers for one touch of her hand. Now, that's a bit melodramatic, but the story teaches us another crucial fact of life. Joy and woe create each other. Pain can lead to genuine joy, but joy definitely makes us more vulnerable to suffering. And another bit of Blake gives us a clue as to how we might deal with that. He writes, "He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise." We must hold on to joy loosely, knowing it is fleeting, but also that it returns. After Maggie dies, Seth goes to the beach at sunrise. He can no longer hear the music, but he has known joy. He kisses it as it flies away. And then he rushes into the ocean to feel the sensation of the thick salt water against his skin for the very first time. Imagine accepting life as it comes, embracing the ebb of joy and the tide of woe as Seth does. He's reborn from angelic purity into complicated humanity, learning about life through vulnerability and brokenness, not perfection and strength. We, too, are called to live with vitality despite our vulnerability. and to work for the healing of all that's broken in us and around us. To do that, we embrace all that life brings. We rush to the beach to kiss away a fleeting joy at sunrise, even though we can't hear the celestial music. We dive into the salt water that caresses our skin, even though it stings our eyes. Shalom. Blessed be. Amen.